Join me on my hunt as we travel in search of stories through the wind door. This journey has been long anticipated, and we are ready.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Through the Wind Door, where we are getting back into our favorite world of Rama, back to our wonderful cat people, starting with chapters 11 through 15 of Tiger's Eye. When I first started rereading, re-listening to this part of the story, before I even got to any potential questions, I had some sort of emotional stuff going on, just the need to write coming out of me, and as a result, I ended up going back and listening to parts of it over and over again so that I could do the thing that I do and create an outline that is more or less concurrent with events as they proceed, so that we can have the podcast in a linear fashion. But today I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to start off, as Alex sometimes does, with a monologue based on some of those feelings that I had coming back to Tiger's Eye. Over the last year, this series that I love has only taken on new definition for me, thanks to Toby and I picking over every part of it. Like Rao hunting for her family, our podcast is about giving honor to this thing that we derive so much enjoyment from. And in doing so, we have come to appreciate it even more. I have gone from a fearful respect of Let Them Go to a more holistic love. I liked Secret Rooms, but thought it incomplete. Now I view it as worthy to stand on its own. And even as we continue on, if we asked me to name my favorite book in the series, I would defend that you can't ask me to pick between my children. And yes, I realize that given the chapters we discussed today, that is a loaded metaphor. Alex has said that thus far, when others are asked to pick their favorite novel, the answers are usually Arlington, The Princess Thieves, and this book, Tiger's Eye. I don't know if this is still true after the release of Steamheart and Uncivil Outlaw, but it's easy to understand why people might name this book. Over the last two episodes, we've talked about how its unique characteristics draw you in. And all of that is still true. But when I first listened to the Tiger's Eye audio drama, it was around the midpoint that I seriously started being riveted by the story. Taking its original straightforward premise and throwing it into chaos by introducing unexpected elements, packing it full of things that I recognized from other previous works, and then mixing them all together into this compelling blend that engaged me to my core. And yet, the crux of why I love this story is something I'm not sure I can explain. Because what I feel isn't literary, it isn't mimetic, it isn't dramatic or troop subverting or any of the stuff we usually talk about. It's something more primal than a couple of years back, Alex wrote this amazing foreword for an episode of School of Movies, where he related a foundational realization he had about his own life after seeing the movie Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. It's one of the most intensely personal and beautiful things that he has shared with an audience. He had a profound experience with the way he responded to a piece of media that is above and beyond the value of that work as a whole. I don't have anything nearly as pithy to say about Tiger's Eye. Not yet, at least. But as I was rereading and re-listening to these chapters, it occurred to me that there is something deeper there. Something is resonating inside me. Not like a tuning fork or part of a musical instrument. It's more ephemeral. Something I can sense, but not entirely comprehend, like a cosmic string.
It has something to do with Miguel, not just in regards to his relationship with Rao, but something in his story, his journey, and the way he tells it.
And for the life of me, I don't know what it is. Because his story and mine are not alike. And it's not a story I specifically recognize from somewhere else. I'm hoping that with Toby's help, I might finally be able to unpack exactly what I'm responding to. Maybe not during this episode, but at least by the time we look back on the entire story as a whole. With that in mind, let us begin.
I feel as if we have now, that our journey throughout the rest of this story has gained a new significance in that we are not just trying or feel that we owe it to the qualities of this story to do its justice, do our analysis in the best way that we can manage, but with that personal resonance that you are describing, I definitely feel a renewed determination to get to the heart of that. So much like the wind door that Rao is trying to journey towards, I want to try and find whatever that inner undefinable quality is. So let's journey forwards together.
I mean, it's just as important for you to relate the things that are important about the story to you as well. This is a collaborative effort.
And oh, of course.
You did mention just a moment ago, and by this I'm referring to pre-podcast conversation, how you were feeling some of the same things as we were getting into these specific chapters in terms mm-hmm. of just the amount of weight that comes with not simply some of the stuff we're going to talk about in terms of changing narrators and stuff like that, but in terms of events as they were transpiring specifically here. So please, if you feel like there is something that you suddenly hit on above and beyond the outline that we've crafted here, then you should let me know. Maybe it's not going to happen in our recording today, but if something clicks later on, make sure that you jot it down so that we can appropriately give reference to it later.
Oh, certainly. And until then, the hunt continues.
We really are enjoying the metaphors.
We are chewing it very thoroughly. I can't stop.
Yeah. No, it's okay. I'm sorry. I just did a really bad one. So it's fine. It's fine. All right. Let's begin at the beginning. Or at least let's begin at the beginning of these chapters.
The middle.
Beginning at the middle. Yes, exactly. Beginning as we mean to go on. When we first were trying to figure out how to divide up our episodic look at Tiger's Eye, unlike as in previous, Tiger's Eye doesn't have parts to it like Let Them Go did, like Secret Rooms does, and like several other books in the series where things are divided up into sections other than just chapters. Sometimes, like, I don't even know if Alex is specifically going behind an act structure, like often happens in plays and movies and such like that. And dividing books up into parts is not unusual either. I've seen other authors do that as well. But it means that as I was putting together our schedule, I had to sort of figure out for myself what divisions of chapters would work out well together. As it turns out, Tiger's Eye has 25 chapters, so I looked at it initially and said, okay, does covering 5 chapters per episode work for these purposes? And the further I went along, like, I could have made another choice that might have worked equally as well. it would have meant that maybe one of our episodes wouldn't have had the same amount to talk about. Not even necessarily to talk about, but there's not the same amount of chapters to cover. We've done that before as things have played out differently, particularly in the case where we chose one episode to just devote all of our attention on one chapter. Having reflected now on the decision that I made to do 5 and 5 and 5, there is a certain... the pattern works out to some degree. And one of the first things that I thought about reading chapter 11 is that I think that was a good choice to do this division of 5 and 5 and 5, because as chapter 10 closes, we are leading into the confrontation with Haka. And while the revelations of chapter 11 do sort of make a major stop, it basically like resolves one of the mysteries that have been running all throughout what we have read so far in terms of the thing that is driving Hrau that has not been completely settled out yet. And not to mention that it's in the very next chapter, chapter 12, we are suddenly dealing with all these cats being kidnapped by the Lions of Albion. It still feels like if I tried ending the previous episode with this fight, then I would be ending in a really heavy spot. Not every chapter ends on a cliffhanger, or at least not a momentous cliffhanger that you necessarily like tune in next time what happens next. When we go forward into further books of New Century, there will be times where there is a revelation at the end of a chapter where we're excited to find out what happens next, but it's not quite the same thing as the traditional concept of a cliffhanger where there is impending doom and, you know, our heroes are surrounded or something major is going on. And it is basically meant as a sort of subtle push towards, don't you want to keep watching this show? Don't you want to know what happens next?
It doesn't have the classic Doctor Who setup of every single episode has to have some very threatening cliffhanger that's like, oh no, how are they going to get out of this one? I don't know, the same way they got out of the last 500 life-threatening cliffhangers that we've seen.
Yeah, but by the same token, choosing to end the previous chapter at chapter 10, it's like, okay, we're about to have a major confrontation. But if I had chosen instead to end at chapter 11, then for those new readers that, I mean, I will say that you don't have to stop where we stop. We're covering the chapters in blocks of time, because if we don't put hard limits on these things, then we'll just continue talking forever, potentially. And that's not necessarily good for us or our time schedule or anything like that. It
does make a fun weekend.
Yeah. And the simple truth of the matter is that we do, in fact, keep talking and talking. Even with editing, this one episode will likely stretch out to 3 or 4 weeks. And the same is true of episode 18, covering chapters 16 through 20. I just finished the outline for the final 5 chapters, and my God, is it long. So without intending to, y'all get a lot of extra content because there is just so much to discuss. So I hope you enjoy listening as much as we have enjoyed talking. But it does feel like beginning with the major events of Chapter 11 make it so that other people aren't weighed down by the power of those events, because finally finding out what happened with Kral, with Rao's child, it's heartbreaking. And you don't necessarily want to leave people with that heavy feeling and not be able to end on something not necessarily more lighthearted, but at the very least something
a momentum to
neutral.
It.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it certainly is this part of the story that, as you touched on earlier, has a full stop quality to it, where the way the chapter ends is he says three words and it is over, she is gone. That's a hell of a resounding echo that to leave you there in what Hrau herself describes as the worst day of her life is, I think it's something that I would encourage anyone who is reading or listening to it. You may want to stay with that for a bit just to kind of let it process your feelings, but don't put the book down for too long because it will be difficult to go forward after that. You kind of need that next line in the first moments of chapter 12 where Hrau is just resolutely saying, "It is not today." It's just that feeling of like, nope, it's not then. And it's sad, but it is a funny moment. But the revelation of that combined with, when I was re-listening to it today, I was taken aback by the remarkable balance and mirroring effect you see within this single episode, this single chapter, because it starts with a confrontation, a clashing of two forces that has been building and building, but now you can't avoid it. It has to happen, and that's Hukka and Hrau. And it ends with this inevitable confrontation of Hrau with the truth as embodied by Hukka, which is, she is gone. That's, I think, this wonderful way of showing the unity of the past and present that Hrau has been trying to avoid confronting, is that yesterday is today. The fact that this flashback is described not as yesterday, she is not consciously remembering it as if it is a memory, she is seeing it as the present, shows that this is not something that stays in the past. It is here in the present, and it has more of an effect on her than she cares to admit.
You're talking a little bit about things being cyclical, which is a metaphor that I know Alex and Sharon love in particular. They talked about it quite a bit, not necessarily in terms of New Century, but for those of you that are regular fans of School of Movies, when they did their most recent...
Ten Futures,
yeah, exactly. They talked about how some of those futures could be considered less bad than others, if only because even if that world is coming to an end, there is potential implication for the fact that life itself is not ending because it's going to come back around again in one form or another. And I guess I'll have to think on that a little bit to see how the idea of cycles plays a greater part in Tiger's Eye as a whole, because on some level it feels like it should. What you were talking about a moment ago in terms of the natural flow of time for these tigers being yesterday, today, and tomorrow feels like that there is a primal aspect to that where it feels less determinative and mathematical than our standard measure of timekeeping. I mean, I guess when you look at the calendar can't help but be cyclical because we're talking about the turn of the seasons and everything like that. But it definitely has a different weight to it that I'll have to consider in greater detail.
For sure. And the way that time is discussed in Tiger's Eye does have a very difficult to wrap your head around. And that's the point, is that we're so set in our own way of measuring time that as soon as we are presented with a different way of viewing time, there's some resistance there. You feel like, that's not how time works. What I love about it is that it has this fluidity to it, but at the same time, it's not necessarily something that's flowing, because yesterday is yesterday, today is today, and tomorrow is tomorrow. But the definitions of what is those things is constantly changing. So to me, it's almost like they are experiencing a constant rolling stasis, that they are always in today. They always have to be in the present. And this is no different to how we make our way through time. That's fair. But there is this quality to this that I think does make you feel like this way of seeing the passage of time helps you to feel fully immersed in the jungle, because the jungle is this fast or connected organism of life, that the system that will go through these cycles, that it will have things that happen on a small level that feel very definitive. If a small animal tries to make its way home and a predator eats it, that is a definitive ending. But there is a cycle to the exchange of life, one thing feeding off another. That means that there is kind of always going to be that present, that future, that past, and there will be certain details that remain the same and others which change. When we get to the lions, we will go into more detail with that. But to me, what makes them such a disruptive force is that they don't necessarily have that feeling of a sort of at-peace stasis. They have a destructive emphasis on progression that leaves little room for things to restore themselves to a point of stasis. And it's, no, we have to develop. And where is this heading to? Well, we don't know. All we know is we'll cut down anything we need to get to there.
Yeah. Of course, in talking about the lions, we're also talking about ourselves. Humanity, or more accurately, First World humanity that is based off decades and centuries of colonialism, as well as literally strip mining the natural world of anything that we can use, and as a result, disrupting the balance in ways that are coming back to roost now in the 21st century. But that's an enormous topic, beyond our remit, and we already have a lot to talk about in the story itself. So, moving on. When I originally wrote this outline, I focused initially on what is basically the second half of Chapter 11 first, but let's skip down to discussing the actual confrontation between Hawkeye and Hrau. And
it's good.
Yeah, it's really good, and one of the things that I appreciated about it is how we have the war of words between the two of them, and then we have the war of physicality between Hawkeye and Hrau. But at the same time, Alex basically has to find a way to have the conversation between Hawkeye and Hrau feel normal. Like, they talk about the things that they know with the full understanding of the things that they know. But obviously, because they understand everything that has happened between them and we don't, it gives us enough to go on to start giving us some of the picture. But like when he says that final line,
"How did you replace Carol with him?"
It takes the events after Hrau has passed out and is, in theory, I guess, dreaming about the past. We need this montage of flashbacks to give us the proper context so that the confrontation between Hrau and Hawkeye and the core struggle that has been going on inside Hrau is fully laid out for the audience. We need it because this is a key point in the story, and understanding it is critical to understanding some of the things that come after. And as people will find out later on, that is not the whole of it. There is an entire separate side of it that will come down much later in the road, but it's a way of letting people know the information they need to know at this point
without having to have any of those clumsy, as you know, exposition dumps, which really wouldn't work well here to begin with, considering the nature of this particular confrontation. Like, when that sort of thing happens in movies and TV shows and the like, it's with the implication they need to make things clear for the audience who doesn't necessarily know all of these things. Sometimes it's as simple as, this is something that happened in a previous episode, maybe you didn't watch that previous episode. And sometimes it's more complicated in terms of explaining the workings of the world, especially in a world that is completely unfamiliar to the audience. But at least very often during those scenes, there is sometimes an audience in the scene that may not know some of what's going on there, so it perhaps doesn't work. It is not as clumsy. Here, it's literally just the two of them, because not even Miguel is a part of that conversation, and it's not like he could understand the conversation between them anyway.
Haka has nothing to say to him.
Yeah, exactly. No, he just has spears for him. If there's one thing I appreciate in terms of Alex's writing in general, but also how he handles this unusual, not necessarily unusual, but how he handles the revelation of information to the audience, particularly as we go on and Alex is revealing information that the audience needs to have in order to be engaged with what's going on, but our protagonists don't. I think it's all handled very well. That's really what I have to say about that.
Oh, completely. And this is where Alex sticks the landing with the first-person narrator framework of this book, because it is a difficult barrier to overcome when it comes to keeping the reader in the dark on certain key details, as you were talking about. But when you're also trying to maintain that first-person narration that keeps things reasonable, it's difficult to kind of balance those, because I mean, imagine if like the references we had to Corral before this moment were along the lines of Corral saying, I haven't been the same since ... then it would draw attention to itself, this sort of moment that feels like that's not really, if someone is going to think about something, it like that feels like quite a indirect but also quite blunt way of doing it. And that's just not how I think internal voices work. It is somewhat like uncontrollable, which is why I like that the references we do get are things like when Hrau initially thinks that weird creature in the river, whatever, I'm just going to leave it. And then she has a fleeting thought of Corral that she can't help but be reminded of, and before she knows what she's doing, it's like, no, I need to do this. And it's because the mind is slippery like that. You can't control it. So the references we get are natural, but leave enough in the dark so that we as the audience go, okay, what was that? Who is it that she was thinking about there? Why isn't she saying anything more about it? And it's because Rao has this credible, well-developed reason for why she avoids anything that might make her think of Corral, because it feels in character for her. It's a reveal that adds a lot to your first reading of this book, but on Reavers, it's the fact that she hasn't been thinking about Corral at all during all of this, or has been avoiding it as much as possible. It just adds even more insight to her character, and it's great. It's framed wonderfully. It's so well earned. I love it. I mean, I love it as much as I can love the most painful memory of Corral's life coming back to haunt her.
Something that we can definitely appreciate without any unusual connotations is we get another dramatic fight scene, which doesn't actually take all that much time, at least not in comparison to, say, the sequence that happened where Haka is possessing all those different animals in order to run Hrau and Miguel to ground and potentially end Miguel's life. All told, it actually takes up a small amount of time, but when I brought it up in the outline, you had something specific to say in terms of the visualization you had as regards Tiger's Eye fight scenes.
The power of this fight is that it's kind of unprecedented in New Century, both physically in terms of the level of physical raw force that's in play here, because as much as the Wendigos are ferocious, they've been up against humans who are relying mainly on technological advantages that they have. They sort of play as more sort of tricks up their sleeve rather than instinctive flurries of movement that you see in this sequence. And
well, they would have to, because they can't let themselves have open wounds in regards to the Wendigo and stuff like that. They literally have to do whatever they can in order to A, avoid spilling blood, and B, avoid having their blood spilled. So there's...
Yeah,
in this particular case, what you're talking about is an actual physical altercation that mimics the ferocity of wild animals like the Wendigo, but there is no other consideration at play. It's two powerful warriors going head-to-head against each other.
And that's why it feels raw, is the word that keeps coming up for me. But it's also unprecedented in terms of the emotions between the two people clashing, because in the stories that we've been looking at, Let Them Go and Secret Rooms, the action is mainly between Wendigos and humans, with a bar scene and the shootout on the road. But in both of those instances, we don't really know the adversaries of our protagonists. They're more like faceless opponents as far as the fight is concerned. There's not a lot of emotional build-up. It's not like Carl, aka Fuck You, is like, "So, Eddie, we meet again! Two forces destined to clash forever."
Will you just shut up?
No, I'm never going to get tired of drawing on Carl. it's because Haka and Frau have been built up all throughout Tiger's Eye, and we haven't seen that in New Century yet. And it's just this explosion of energy and feelings. And there are moments in the fight where, honestly, there's an intimacy there that really does kind of hint at their relationship in the past, that feels like you guys might have some pent-up feelings from the past at one point or another, right?
Don't make me tap the sign, Toby. No spoilers. All in good time.
The point I wanted to come to is that there is this explosion of energy kind of reminded me, and the way the narration frames it, I visualized it as this furious exchange of blows as their combined weight is thrown around and it crashes into anything and everything around them. And the fight scene that came to mind for me was in the 2018 God of War game by Santa Monica Studio. And it's very early on in that game where the main character Kratos has this explosive, desperate struggle against a mysterious combatant. The cinematics of that fight follow the game's conceit of a free-flowing camera that stays with the characters without ever, quote-unquote, cutting to another angle or shot. This makes that fight scene a soaring and memorable encounter where you finally see your protagonist cut loose and show them going all out against an opponent who is matching them step for step. And that's the feeling I get from this fight between Frau and Haka. It's frantic, but it's clearly conveyed by the narration taking you through each movement so that you feel this is frantic, but it's not aimless. There is very much a clear direction of energy that they are aiming straight at their opponent.
I like your comparison to that particular game and the cinematic quality of it in there, because one of the things that I picture naturally is, particularly when we think about the two of them face to face and Haka is saying that memorable line, "How could you replace Carol with him?" In the audio drama, it immediately cuts out to this like heavy breathing, and we can tell that something has interrupted him. And the way I actually see that scene playing out in my mind is them being face to face and Haka yelling, and then all of a sudden his face just goes dry or shaky, and we don't understand what's just happened, but we finally come back out of that first person cinematic where all we can see is the two of them, and we realize that just out of shot we see the moment where Miguel has run up and pierced Haka's side with his wrist blades. And that just works really well for me there. The idea of we're keeping with this modality for the next few moments, and then all of a sudden that is suddenly interrupted, and the interruption is itself cutting away to what we can't see out of frame.
Exactly. And it's almost punctuated by the little guitar riff that often accompanies Miguel in some of his most significant personal moments and memories of the past, is when you see what he has done, it is this moment of power. Doesn't feel quite accurate, but it is a moment where what the potential of Miguel and who he is and his spirit feels like it's at its sharpest. And I'm sure that Haka would agree.
Wow. Okay. I think I'm going to have to go back and do a re-listen to certain parts then, because I don't think I realized that there was an undercurrent of guitar that was associated with Miguel himself. Are you familiar with the concept of a leitmotif?
Yes.
Okay. This was something that I had to have someone teach to me a while back, because he would talk about how certain great composers would often use that in regards to, as you say, giving particular characters their own sort of background music, or even just swelling themes or whatever that are intrinsic whenever they're doing something important or dramatic on the set. I'm now very glad that Toby pointed this out, but I'm not going to go back and try to find every instance of it now that I realize this was a thing. That would take far too long. But if you listen to that one moment where Hrau narrates the wound that Miguel made, you can hear a few notes of plucked guitar strings. And when we move on to chapter 13, that same guitar is heard after Alex narrates the first sentence of Miguel's story. Composers in movies have not always maintained true with that. The greatest example of this sort of thing is anything that John Williams has ever done, particularly in movies like Star Wars and stuff like that. For those of you that are unaware, just the straight-up definition of a leitmotif is a recurrent theme throughout a musical or literary composition associated with a particular person, idea, or situation. Whenever you're dealing with a movie or a TV show, there is still a script that's going on at play. There is still a story that is going on at play. But to have music that is emblematic of a specific character in the background of a scene is a way of adding further contextual depth, particularly if the music itself is changed in order to reflect on whatever is happening in the scene. Maybe when we do a Sounds of New Century episode, we'll take a closer look at how Alex has used music in various ways throughout his work. Because sadly, among all the topics we discuss, the music often gets short shrift, and that's not fair, considering how important it has been.
It invokes a feeling.
Yeah, exactly. And the larger soundtracks will often do that and have, like, yeah, everyone knows what it means whenever we're having a major action scene and the standard opening sequence to Indiana Jones starts playing. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Yay, we're about to have a major indie scene and everything like that. For those of you that haven't been following along with Graham Stark and Matt Wiggins in their James Bond podcast, From Rewatch with Love, they most recently covered Casino Royale, the first Daniel Craig Bond outing. And one of the things they pointed out is that since it's framed a little bit as a soft reboot and Bond origin story, they don't really use the traditional Bond musical theme until the very end,
when he has fully become the version of James Bond we have seen in all movies previous. It's never been my strength to always notice stuff that's going on musically, and I've had a bit of a workout in that regard in terms of not only noticing music as it plays out in the new century audio dramas, but also the things that I've learned along the way as a result of School of Movies in terms of reused themes or just whatever Alex has to say about the music and what it means to the specific situation. The recent deconstruction that he did, where he was talking about a piece of music that was specifically being used in Armageddon, I think it was, and how that related to the music that he specifically picked out. Well, not Aerosmith specifically, I don't think. I think that this was a piece of music that didn't have words associated with it. It wasn't an Aerosmith song. But the thing that he was comparing it to was the theme song specifically for Steamheart, and how as the music built upon itself, how the introduction of different instruments were supposed to be symbolic of the different ideas that Alex wanted to plant in people's heads in terms of what kind of a story this was, that this was a journey, that there was a bit of flute that was supposed to symbolize the hope inherent of what they wanted to get out of this amazing road trip in terms of protecting the country and everything like that. The bit from the Armageddon podcast is really good and worth sharing for those that haven't heard it. But I think I will hold off till we actually get to Steamheart, so it's properly situated where it belongs. After all, we still have a lot of Tiger's Eye to get through, and if we're going to talk about music, then let's talk about Tiger's Eye music.
For sure, and let me put it this way. With all sorts of artistic media, I feel and appreciate the emotions that they instill in me. And with film and television, and that I have a language that I can use to deconstruct and analyze what's going on. I have an understanding of the framework that goes into it. So I can say, this is what's going on. It has this effect. And that's why I feel the end result that I am experiencing. And I have that with other things. You know, when I'm reading a book or indeed listening to an audio drama, I can pick apart the different component pieces. That it is not necessarily something that I would be able to do for myself to as effective a standard or an outcome, but at the very least, I would have an idea of where to start if I wanted to construct my own version of it. Music is one of those mediums that, or media that I will appreciate so much. It has such a sharp effect on me. I don't have the slightest idea where to start with picking it apart. It's like, oh, I like the bit where it goes da 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 da. Or like, I can't describe it. It's I know how to play a piano somewhat, but like I have no idea what any of this terminology is or like how anyone writes any music. I just think like I have no idea where anyone starts. Like, what is the first draft for a piece of music look like? I honestly don't know. That's why it feels like magic to me, because I can appreciate the end result, but there is no way I can reverse engineer it to be able to say this is the starting place that this came from.
I've talked plenty about how people are pattern matching machines, and some people just see different patterns in different things. I appreciate that, but whenever I pick a piece of music for an outro, it's very often like sometimes there may be a specific sound that I particularly like for whatever chapters we cover or whatever themes or topics we covered for that time. But very often when I'm drawing upon it, it's not the music that comes to mind. It's specifically the lyrics and what the lyrics, what story they weave for the listener to enjoy, or whatever tonality it sets and how that might relate to the topic at hand. Some songs
are like just evoke imagery. Some songs tell a story, and some songs are more like poetry. When we're talking about something, like, say, Suzanne Vega or something like that, who is one of my favorites, but who there is a great deal of like, you need to figure out your own interpretation of this, much like you would have to come up with your own interpretation of abstract art or something like that. You know, what does this bring out in you? It's always going to be more personal if there's no clear intent in whatever the artist is trying to do, that, or at the very least, if it's using words and ideas that you can't immediately put together your own pattern for. If there's something that I've appreciated with the advent of the internet, it's that people will sometimes put up websites where they talk about, okay, what does this song actually mean? And sometimes, because sometimes I'm able to figure out these things by myself, but sometimes it takes someone else and their understanding of the words and the metaphor being invoked here that feel very useful for me as an altering perspective to songs that I enjoy, understanding, oh, why did you enjoy it? Oh, okay, well, that's really interesting. And that's why Through the Wind Door exists. This is just our particular take on everything that's going on there. I'm not going to say that I'm unable to talk about some of these important aspects. When I came up with, say, some of the original intros and outros for Through the Wind Door, I was looking for a specific kind of sound. And in particular, the piece of music that I picked out for Secret Rooms, which is called The Talons of Adventure, The Antlers of Romance by Dr. Turtle. That's a piece that I found on freemusicarchive.com. And I think I originally picked out that particular piece of music because there were elements of it. First of all, there were instruments being used that sort of evoked the idea of the South or of that particular time and place that I felt worked really well. But there was also the music was basically mostly finger-picked guitar. And it made me think a great deal of that one particular theme that sort of just hits everybody sideways from the show Deadwood.
The piece is called Iguazu by Gustavo Santaolalla, and the finger-picked guitar is just beautiful and haunting in ways I find difficult to elucidate. But I'll include a link in the show notes for others to enjoy.
It's one of those pieces of music that I specifically associate with Deadwood, and since we're in a more of a Wild West setting here, when I heard that song as I was shopping around for a new beginning theme, I was like, that's the one that speaks to me right there. And it took me a while to understand what was being resonated there.
Well, all I can say is I am looking forward to seeing what music speaks to you with Tiger's Eye, and I am, my fingers crossed, that most of it will be the soundtrack to Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats.
Now, that feels a little bit too, like, I'd have to actually listen to some of that stuff again, but I just feel like it would be really weird if we introduce every episode with the introduction that we have planned that you're going to record for me, and then suddenly lead into Jellicle Cats, Water of Sighs.
Because Jellicle Cats are Jellicle
Cats. Yeah, okay. I guess I do have some of this stuff in mind.
Well, I guess I know what music I'm going to invoke when we do the outtakes for this episode.
I was just hit by the weirdest sensation. Is there a German word for the experience of being excited for a thing that you are currently doing?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know German, but I'm guessing you could probably make a word that says that
because
if you only knew enough German words and then just combine them all together like they do.
Because there is just a feeling of like, oh man, I'm so excited for this series that we are at this very moment working on. It's like I have an anticipation for something that it is currently happening. It's odd and bizarre, and I love it. Who moves first?
Yeah, exactly. Now, well, I mean, I would say that this is part of the reason why I'm not always very good at maintaining a schedule, because I always try and have something ready for the next week, but very often by the time that I've done, you've noticed, I can't wait until Monday a lot of the time. I have to, okay, it's done. I have to release this into the wild because I want people to hear what we've put together. And I feel like that's probably similar to what you're feeling right now. Just the idea of, this is some really good stuff here, not just in our conversation, but also in the other things that we want to include. And we just want to bring that to life, much like we would our own child. Mm. And that brings us right back to the topic.
Oh, no. Memories.
Oh, God, no. Do you know that that's one of the few songs that I had to... I learned far in advance of my ever even hearing about the musical Cats. I think I learned it, I want to say, in grade school or more likely middle school chorus class. Yeah, and I think I really liked it at the time, in particular because I still had... my boy's soprano voice, so I could really hit those notes and feel like I was doing a good job singing it. I enjoy singing in general, but I gotta say that when my voice broke and I went from having a wonderful soprano to something that eventually evolved into a middle-of-the-road baritone, I missed not being able to sing some of my favorite songs directly on key because I couldn't reach those notes anymore.
I can understand that. I have a I mean, I have no idea how I describe this voice that you're listening to, but it's certainly not musical.
Oh, fair enough. We've been talking a lot here and we've been getting away from the subject, so let's get back on track here, particularly if we're going to have a hard limit to this. Although, you know, we have an entire week, and who knows how things are going to turn out within the next couple of days. Maybe we want to take some time out and do another recording anyway if we don't manage to talk about everything. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Take our minds off of whatever's going on.
Yep.
So, the topic of finding out about Coral finally for the first time, it puts everything into perspective now, especially now that the fight scene leads directly onto that montage of images where we see Coral interacting with the world and Crow being an observer and just being so taken with and in admiration of this child that is hers. And then the hard-hitting, like, experience of suddenly they're not there and they don't know what happened and their mind is racing 100 miles a minute as they try and figure out what has happened. And then as they are hoping that the worst thing that they are potentially imagining, that it hasn't happened, so they got to keep searching. They got to keep searching to the point where... I'm sorry if I'm making this difficult.
No, please go on, please.
Okay, fair enough. The thing that comes to mind, there have been a number of occasions during storytelling, usually visual storytelling, that are a little bit similar to this moment. There's the one that people like to make fun of from the video game Heavy Rain, where the protagonist has lost his son in a crowd and is looking...
Jason!
Yeah! Sean! Jason! Sean!
Jason!
Yeah. I mean, I definitely understand what they were going for there, but I don't necessarily know that that scene in particular is necessarily bad. I think that people make fun of it a little bit primarily because of some of the ridiculous stuff in the rest of the movie, or excuse me, in the rest of the game.
Those are good scenes. They like, especially when you're playing them and there's a sense of active involvement and effect on what you're seeing. It feels like, okay, wait, no, if I find them, then maybe things can get better. So there, I think that's exactly the sort of scene to invoke, because it really is what is going on here.
Yeah, fair enough. I don't know. I have, like, we're not, this isn't our remit to talk about Heavy Rain, and maybe some of my feelings are weighed down by other people talking shit about it, but I at least appreciate what they were trying to accomplish there in terms of the overall tone and how that incorporates itself into the gameplay mechanics of that game.
I can't believe I was actually trying to say something nice about a video game made by David How Many Emotions Is People Cage, and can only chalk it up to the fact that I forgot the recent news about his studio, Quantic Dream. But once more, I digress. Back on topic.
But something that works, that does work very well, and in spite of all the issues that are clearly with, say, Minority Report, one of the hardest hitting moments in that particular movie has always been Tom Cruise's character, John Anderson, you know, taking his eyes off of his son for a moment because they're doing that thing in the pool. And then all of a sudden he sees the watch and comes out and he doesn't see his son. And he's racing around like a madman trying to find what happened. That is definitely an effective moment in the story that reflects on the events as they are playing out here in Tiger's Eye.
Yeah. Brow uses this word, and it is exactly what this sequence is. It's a nightmare. And I don't use that word just to say, oh, this situation is horrible. That means it's a nightmare. No, this is when you are trapped in your head, indulging in the fear of the worst thing that could possibly happen, that the person that is most precious to you is suddenly gone. And no matter what you do, no matter how many times you go over it, they remain gone and you're just looking and looking. And, hey, this feels familiar. Wait a minute. Didn't Alex do a scene very like this in Let Them Go when we were doing the hide and seek? Alex, what are you doing to me?
Yeah, okay, that's fair. It's an effective storytelling tool. I'm not going to deny it.
The trope that's being invoked here is referred to on TVTropes.org as adult fear.
We're not necessarily afraid of monsters that don't exist. We're afraid of real, understandably real concepts like your child going missing or being taken from you by sickness or just there are a number of other things, but like your child being kidnapped, that's kind of right at the top of the list of the things that adults fear most when they have let that kind of thing into their lives. Like, obviously, if you're not a father or you're not a mother, then it necessarily isn't going to feel the same way. But another example of how effectively that gets played out that comes to mind is the response that Winona Ryder's character has in Stranger Things to one of her sons going missing. I mean, there's a lot that can be talked about there, but again, that's going beyond our remit. And if you want to hear a really excellent discussion of how Winona Ryder experiences that, but also uses it as fuel to not give up, that I highly recommend listening to the School of Movies episodes on season one of Stranger Things, as well as their retrospective on seasons two and three, which they did long after the fact. It's all good stuff, and it's a good show to begin with, so I highly recommend that.
Yeah. You were mentioning just a moment ago that it's something that hits harder if you're a mother or a father. But I think something that, and this will sound so mundane considering the subject matter, but I think everyone experiences that powerless frustration when there's something important that they have lost, that they, something like a wallet or a set of keys, and you can't leave the house until you get the keys, and there's something important you need to get to, but you can't find it. It's this cyclical thing that you keep covering the same ground, and it, there's nothing that makes you feel quite so powerless and helpless as the feeling that this has to be around here. I know it's here. I just need to find it, but I keep searching the same places. And now imagine that as a person, someone that you care about. And I think the most horrifying moment in this comes in the middle, not at the end, when Harrow finds the tar pit and she doesn't say, she just says, this cannot be what has happened to my daughter. And then the rest of the sequence is looking for anything, just something.
She cannot accept this as a possible truth. Therefore, she has to protect her own mind from ever accepting this by searching for any scrap of evidence to disprove it.
The reason why I am shaking right now, this is an audio medium, so you can't see that, but maybe my voice will convey it, is that that is so tangible. That is such a tangible fear. We were talking about adult fear, that I think, to make a huge generalization, I feel that the key difference between childhood fears and adult fears is that as a child, you fear monsters or situations where nebulous events or people exert power over you, because you are acutely aware that you don't necessarily have the power to control and affect these situations due to your age and inexperience. Adult fear is being shown very sharply that your own power is not enough. And by that I mean that when the most important thing in the world relies on you, that you are not enough.
Yeah. You were talking about the cyclical nature of that experience with her a moment ago, and it's literally, I guess, a vicious circle of unending dread and fear and inability to accept the truth, such to the point where an outside force literally has to come to her in the form of Hawkeye in order to break her out of it. The idea of maintaining a certain kind of emotional state because you fear what it is that's on the other side of that, that's also a very understandable psychological thing. And this will not be the only time we discuss the idea of needing to maintain and feed an emotional state in order to prevent oneself from accepting a truth. One of the moments that I remember from, of all things, just a standard piece of tie-in fiction to one of my favorite Dungeons & Dragons worlds, was a discussion of talking to someone about why it is that they couldn't let go of their anger of someone else. Why it is that they had to continue to pursue them in order to exact some measure of revenge. And someone else speaks up very clearly and says that if she doesn't sustain the anger, what does she have left? That she doesn't want to feel the pain and despair that is on the other side of having some kind of closure. As long as she, as long as she stays angry, then she doesn't have to confront what comes after that. She doesn't have to feel the pain. She can instead cause pain to someone else that she feels deserves it.
Right. It's the feeling that fuels revenge tragedies, that idea that, or just revenge narratives in general, is that your first instinctual reaction is this sharp feeling of, I need to exert all of my frustration and feelings of powerlessness over the thing that's caused this, and it's something to focus on. And then eventually it caves in on itself, either before the revenge is enacted or just afterwards, where you realize you are now left with nothing else but the emptiness, the echoing full stop of that loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, instead of focusing now on how difficult this moment is emotionally to both you and I, let's now reflect on how this revelation colors everything that came before. Mm-hmm. Because now we have a clearer understanding of why it is Hrau has been going about like she has. Mm-hmm. She has been responding in unexpected ways because she has been following the instinct of being a parent immediately upon associating Miguel with them specifically being a child themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the reason why she feels protective of him, why she saves his life to begin with, and why she continues to reach out without completely understanding what's going on inside her own head. Mm-hmm. And following that through line further, as Hrau takes on the responsibility of getting Miguel back to his home, if not his own parents, because obviously Hrau has not really communicated the relationship between him and his parents, or should I say parent, on the other side of the wall. She eventually comes to the conclusion to be like, I will not always be with him. I need to ensure that he is able to take care of himself if I am doing something else, so goes into the mode of trying to train him how to be a hunter. And we expect that she did much of some of the same stuff with Coral herself. I mean, one of those scenes towards the end, before Coral disappears, is in fact Hrau having taken Coral out to learn how to hunt, even though Coral is distracted by just the general beauty and wonder of the world around her. So she is falling into familiar patterns here, and she has an explanation in her own head that makes sense for the situation. But now that we understand this past context, we see that, oh, there is something else, something greater at work here.
Hmm.
And now, all of a sudden, I have a flash of insight. I go back to the beginning to check, where I realize that something Toby and I completely skipped over was that Coral had been name-dropped way back in Chapter 2, something I had utterly forgotten. This extra detail confirms the thought I already had in mind. Here, the mental imagery is too synchronistic. If Coral did in fact drown in the tar, as the text alludes to, then the sight of Miguel slipping beneath the water must have been a trigger for her. In those brief moments, she made a mental connection between Miguel and her lost cub. And in spite of her vocal thoughts, the notion in my mind is that she couldn't stand there and do nothing. Her inability to save Coral simply by not being there for her in the past urged her to take action now when she could.
It's something that feels like what she has been doing is she's very practically focused. It's all very much a case of what needs doing next. And so when she's training Miguel to be a hunter, to fend for himself, to us, the audience, that's something that feels very parental, so we can mark it as a moment of the two getting closer, or a step towards them getting closer. But to Hrau, I don't think she really entertains the notion that this is a parental thing to do.
No.
Because to her, it's a case of, no, it's practical. This is my companion on this journey, and it will probably make more sense if he has some means of defending himself. That is the practical thing. The emotional connection doesn't really come into her decision at all in it, whereas I think for Corral, it's really is an opportunity for them to bond to the point that when the hunting is so not the end result, at least by the end of it, that they end up just essentially dancing together instead. And it's lovely and beautiful, but it does mean that Hrau sort of makes things so practical.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that comes into mind is that it suddenly lends perspective as to an additional aspect of why this piece of mythology about the Gagaku was revealed to us towards the beginning of the story. At first, it's just flavor text, as we are experiencing a tale that Hunta told to Hrau when she was very young, especially during a time when her mother was still around. And then, of course, the mask of that the Silent One wears is meant to be reminiscent of the Gagaku. But facing that for herself, especially when the Gagaku is invoked in the disappearance of Corral, and of course you remember that that's part of the mythology, that the Gagaku whisks away naughty children and stuff like that, especially when they're sleeping. That lends an entire different weight to how difficult it must have been for Hrau during those moments to make herself vulnerable. Like, she says that she suspected that it was, in fact, the Silent One wearing a costume, but given that this is the thing that comes to mind during a time of, as you say, the worst day in Hrau's life, that there was a subtext going on there that we couldn't possibly have understood until we found out the circumstances of Corral's disappearance and quote-unquote death.
It is a chillingly effective touch at the start of the flashback sequence with Corral that we do hear some of those pipe notes that were played earlier when we're told of the Gagaku's call. We hear those notes long before Corral goes missing. It's kind of at the start of us hearing about what their relationship was like, and it immediately tells you where this is heading, and it means that the slow build-up to it is heart-wrenching and unbearable, because it's this invisible threat and you can't really stop it. So I think that's why, that's the horror it speaks to, is this feeling of these lovely memories being corrupted by that unbendable moment when it was all taken away, or it all slipped away. That's the strength of it, is that if we are told about the Gagaku and that it steals children away, and then it was revealed that there was actually a Gagaku that actually took Corral away, then that would feel that would hurt, but it would feel a bit more definitive, and that would take away some of the pain of this moment, which sounds like that should be a better thing, but I think it's much more immediately easier to connect with when it has this sort of real world feeling of this can happen, and it doesn't necessarily need this literal supernatural entity to have taken Corral away. It is the embodiment of something just happening all at once. One day your life changes forever. But I don't know where I'm necessarily leading to with this, but it is certainly something which is this extra little note that makes the flashback feel almost like horror.
As we already know from both Secret Rooms and Let Them Go, a lack of resolution makes an open wound worse over time. For Abigail, it was being unable to know what happened to her family. In Let Them Go, it was more complicated, because Rebecca would seem to have clearly defined her boundary in asking Rafe not to return. But as she herself admits, she always hoped he would anyway. We've talked about the idea of arrested development before,
which is usually all about boys and girls and those in between suffering mental or social impairment as a result of some outside influence. And apparently, even though psychologists no longer like using that term, the concept itself is still useful to me, using it to describe the idea of parts of a human psyche entering a form of stasis. It's just that now, instead of using it in the case of teenage James and Abigail, I have to consider the idea that it could happen to anyone, at any age. True, our preteen and adolescent years are when we do our most development of ourselves. But ideally, we should always be growing, and being open to learning new things. Becoming a different person than we were. Kral's death changed Hrau. And seemingly, Miguel is waking that part of her back up.
I once again, I'm glad that you noticed the presence of a specific musical cue that was related to stuff that we'd heard previously. This was, again, I've been enjoying the music of Tiger's Eye, but I wasn't necessarily picking out individual parts here and there. Like, I had that one thing where I noticed the whistling of the kettle all the way back and Let Them Go, and how that was mirrored later on in the actual background non-diegetic music. But you're just hitting it out of the park with noticing when certain notes or certain instruments come into play in order to represent what is playing out on, not on the screen, obviously we don't have the screen, but for us to hear in the audio drama. So well done.
Oh, thank you. This is jumping very far ahead. So in the edit future, Greg, do feel free to either cut this entirely and refer to it later, or to just lift this and put it to when we're talking about chapter 13. But when we're hearing about Miguel being sick to his stomach when they stole from the kindest people they knew, and he tells his father resolutely that he will not steal again, when he's talking about how he likes to think of the determination he had then more than he wants to think about what happened next, It plays very softly, the sort of Tiger's Eye theme, the I'm butchering it, but I think at that point Miguel is still far away from Rama, but again, that idea that I touched on earlier, the potential of who he can grow into, that his father Francisco is snuffing out or attempting to stomp out of him, He in that moment shows the bravery that he will show in the rest of this story in Rama. So the musical cue there is just a little bit of, even at that point, he is connected to the person he will become in Rama.
Well, let's go there for a second. We can come back to the events of chapter 12 as we start discussing the Lions of Albion more in relation to how they affect Miguel going forward in chapter 15. You talk about how that music is supposed to be representative of who Miguel will become in Rama. I think I'm going to take a slightly different tack on that. We're not doing an overview of what actually happens, because we've gotten away from that. We assume You, the audience, have already listened to or read all of these chapters, so you know everything that we're going to talk about there. But there is an importance, I think, that comes with relating Miguel's story from the very beginning. Like, To a certain extent, it goes even further back in time than even, say, some of those flashback sequences for James and Abigail in secret rooms, but also possibly with some of the other flashback stuff that's happened in other parts of New Century, such as Let Them Go or Steamheart or anything like that. The only thing that comes close would possibly be some of the early stuff in Princess Thieves. Once again, we're getting away from the topic. But
This darn series, there's just so much to talk about.
There is just so much to talk about. It's fine. But you know, thinking about it, because the events that happen with Miguel and how his life intersects with the events of New Century in general, with the outbreak of the Wendigo,
mm-hmm.
Miguel was super young back when all of that was happening, and it basically tore apart his life as his father ran off with him in order to save their own skin. But even within the flashback of Miguel telling his story, if there's something that Miguel does as he takes over the part of the first person narrative, it's that he does an awful lot of he does more reflecting on what has come in the past than Hrau herself does. He doesn't always remember these things clearly, and when he's telling his story, he does start at the beginning and move forward in a general linear fashion right up until we get to the point of him actually coming through the wind door and meeting Hrau for the first time, at which point the narrative tends to skip around a lot in terms of, okay, this happened, but it makes me think about the events that happened before this. It's basically Alex trying not to retread every linear moment that has happened between, because those every moment isn't necessarily needful. We've seen how things proceeded from Hrau's perspective, and we don't need to see every moment also from Miguel's perspective, only the stuff that is specifically relevant.
The stuff that we could infer in the original sequence of events that Miguel means, like the one I keep referring to is the when Miguel's kind of a bit sassy, like sort of like, you know where we go, like we don't need to see it from his perspective. We got what he meant from that. So, but it's the key moments, the things that are valuable for us to see, like what did Miguel think of Hrau's father? What was his experience like when he was ill? What was his first meeting with Hrau like, and what did he think of her? All of that is important to see his view on things.
Right. And the thing that he comes back to so often, because he needs a better source of inspiration and hope than Francisco, his awful father, can provide, is the experience and the voice of Abuelita, his grandmother. He keeps using the few things that he remembers from when he was a little boy to better steel him and inform him on what it is that's going on right now, particularly in terms of understanding the great cats and the lucha libre and everything that occurs there. He still remembers the influence of his grandmother on his life, even though he was so very young when that happened. And we don't actually find out about her until after the opening moments of his story, which is the relation of how he and his father fled, basically. As Miguel is taking over narrating duties, he moves around between past and present with a lot more fluidity than Hrau herself does, which is understandable because Hrau is trying to avoid the past for the most part.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, she's trying to edit out. She's trying to avoid thinking about that worst day of her life. So if she is thinking about things, then they are moments that distinctly do not include Corral or existed at a time before Corral did.
What I mentioned a moment ago about the Miguel preferring to remember the like feelings he had rather than the pain he experienced is in some ways similar to Hrau in the case of selective memory, or at least emphasizing certain memories over others. But on the other hand, I think it's actually quite a different approach to memories of painful experiences, where I think Miguel has identified the thing that he can take from that experience, which is of value, which can help him. He remembers all of these bad experiences with his father, and he relays them quite clearly to us. Mm-hmm. He communicates what that made him feel, but he's also able to convey moments of him seizing hope, which I think is valuable. The idea that his father took away everything from him, but he still held onto the recruitment papers and that side of things.
You know, thinking about it, there's a distinct difference in the stories of Frau and Miguel that are part of the reason why this difference in narrative makes a certain degree of sense. We don't necessarily know a whole lot about Frau's earlier life, but the overall implication is that if Frau had problems as a child or growing up, becoming an adult and all that sort of thing like that, it's never gone into all that much. It's not a significant part of the story. Yeah. Therefore, all of the weight is centered around losing Carol, because, again, we keep saying it, but it's still true, the worst day of Rao's life.
Yeah, we've double-checked it, and the facts are in. Losing a kid still sucks.
Yeah, exactly. But
we have to laugh.
Unfortunately.
Hiding real pain.
Yeah. In the case of Miguel, however, he can't compartmentalize any of that.
Yes.
Like, Tiger's Eye is a coming-of-age story for Miguel, where he finally, like, he's had all of these experiences beforehand, but now he finally has a surrogate parent and teach him better how to be in the world and how to be who he is and how to grow up to be an adult in ways that his father's quote-unquote teachings were toxic at best and really just using Miguel at worst. Miguel's experience of life is too full of bad things and pain. Some of them forced upon him by his father, and some of him just the experience of, you know, the Wendigo losing members of his family and the abuse that Francisco heaped upon him by being such a poor parent in general and being a manipulative, murderous fuckbag. So all of that already informs who Miguel is as a person. The reason why I decided to focus on this now as opposed to come back to it later is because a moment ago when you were talking about Miguel becoming the person that he would be in our story, I think it's important to designate that Miguel was already becoming that person throughout his life, because he's in a shitty situation, and so therefore that moment where he says no to his father, even though he was very young when he did it, that is already a major definitive moment for him. And it just brings into play, it informs and it strengthens the actual events that take place in Rama. You know, a leitmotif isn't what it is because it's meant to be representative of potential. It's meant to be representative of that person. And who we are definitely grows and changes due to the experiences and the traumas that we have over the course of our life. So if anything, I would probably have to go back and actually pay close attention to some of those music stylings. The thing that I wonder is if in the early days of Miguel's life, if those particular guitar notes were like lighter and less intense, and as he becomes more confident with himself and grows to be who he is by the end of this story, if the overall strength or depth of the music gains definition along the way, because that would be really interesting overall in terms of how the music is contributing to the story.
I can't say either way on that, because it always feels quite sharp to me whenever it comes up. The three moments I can say with certainty when they pop up are when it's revealed that Miguel stabbed Haka. Mm-hmm. When Miguel's narration first begins, when he says, "My name is Miguel," and he introduces himself after he finishes his first line, the guitar plays again as a way of almost showing we are now seeing Miguel's story.
It's and punctuation.
It's a signature. It's a signature that puts a seal on, like, his character. And the one time it shows up is when we first hear about the Natchez, and we're told that he sort of listened at the door to. Mm-hmm. So even though it's brought up when the Natchez is mentioned, it doesn't feel like it's necessarily a musical cue for the Natchez as much as it is of Miguel suddenly catching something.
In that way, it sounds more like a musical sting that would come up in, say, an indie movie. The theme music playing lightly in the background as whatever is on screen suggests a call to adventure.
To go back to what you were saying, I do think I agree with your sentiment that it's not that he experiences a change. It's more that who he is allowed to, or not allowed to, but it's encouraged and developed to bring out. And I think that's much more important than saying that, oh, Miguel didn't have this thought before. He absolutely did.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us to discussing Francisco Delgado in...
Must we?
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. I brought it up. I knew that was going to be the exact words that you were going to use. The reason I think it's important we discuss him in brief is, like, he's not necessarily going to be a significant part of the story beyond these specific chapters, but it's important to highlight that we have a much stronger reaction to the Elder Delgado than we have to any other male antagonist thus far. It's the story of a father using, abusing, and gaslighting his own son from a tender age, putting Miguel in an impossible situation where he relies on his father for love and protection, where he has no one else. He doesn't have Abuelita. He doesn't have his mother anymore. He has no one else to stand by him. Francisco deliberately takes advantage of all of that. And we bear witness to Miguel's bravery as he grows to understand, without any outside influence, without anybody helping him to this conclusion, he understands that his father is a monster and he will only let himself be corrupted so far before stepping back from the abyss.
Mm. It's as painful as it is because, as we touched on in the interview with Matt, Francisco is someone who has so much influence over the world he has active control over, which is Miguel's world. True, someone like Buck has a unfortunate sway over how things may or may not go in a settlement, and Dawson is an unfortunate presence in a room full of survivors. But there is something with the way we see Francisco just get his fingers into him and say, "You are my son, you do what I say." He does, and he never even says that. It's just, "We're going to play a game, and this is what it is." And I'm just realizing now that when Miguel suggests playing chess, that I thought we might play it together, when he's suggesting an actual game to him, he says, "Oh, we don't play games anymore." So it's very much a case of, "We do games on my terms, not on yours, and it will only ever be as a practical benefit to me not as something that you will enjoy or get anything out of.
Francisco is definitely a bit of a manipulator, not just of Miguel, but of other people, as he can manage it. Mm-hmm. And when you bring up the chessboard, the thing that comes to mind is that chess is a very tactical game where you have to weigh up your resources and then plan accordingly in terms of how it is they're best going to achieve victory. And so when Miguel was young, Francisco was basically using him as literally as a pawn, as a chess piece to move around in order to attain victory however he could. And only now that Miguel won't let himself be manipulated so far, he realizes that he has to use different tactics when using Miguel to his own devices, because he has lost some of his usefulness as a pawn if he questions his father, if he has a spine, basically. Mm. Therefore, the idea of we don't play games anymore, I feel like there could be two pieces of meaning behind that. That one, you know, their relationship has changed as soon as Miguel put a hard barrier on what he would or wouldn't do. Mm. And
as a result of that change, it means that Francisco can't convince Miguel to do a thing by making it seem not as bad. Framing it as a game in the past was a way to get Miguel to buy in. That doesn't work anymore. So in this case, not playing games is more metaphorical than literal. But the second thought that comes to mind is, in order to maintain whatever control Francisco has over Miguel, he doesn't necessarily want to encourage Miguel to become more like him.
Mm.
He doesn't want to make him better at fighting his father, basically. And that could potentially
put them on an even playing field.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea of denying him a teaching moment that chess could definitely be feels like that is Francisco continuing to flex whatever influence he has left in order to keep some measure of control over his son.
Mm. It's also something that feels like chess would be something that he would not be especially good at, because as much as Francisco has a talent for manipulating people to get what he wants, he certainly seems to not have that much forethought, because they keep having to move from place to place. And at the start, you think it's that, Miguel got caught. But more often than not, it sounds like it was Francisco making enemies and deciding, we're going to move now. And you get that sense, because at first it said, oh, we're moving against the tide because that's the best way to survive. And Miguel kind of intuits that, well, it's because you're afraid that your past is going to catch up with you eventually. Mm. And the line that occurs to me that this reminds me of is this character in Adventure Time. This is a bit of a spoiler, I suppose, for Finn, the main character's father. So if you are catching up with that series late, then skip ahead. But Finn's father, when you eventually meet him, is very much kind of a non-active parent. Finn keeps coming to try and get his dad to be, like, to give him some sort of answers or some sort of satisfaction, but he keeps kind of wanting to just move on with his own life and move away from Finn. At one point, when Finn has made a major decision independent of his father that he won't pursue this option that will take him in a direction in life that will be away from his friends, the father says, oh, that option sounds good, can I get in on that? And Finn says, are you ever going to not do this sort of thing? And the line he says in response is, when you burn enough bridges, the only way is to move forward.
Mm.
And that's Francisco to me. He doesn't have the long-term plan that a game of chess usually... I mean, to be fair, I don't really play chess with much of a long-term plan either, but it's... in terms of what it represents, I think that Francisco is not a chess player. He's someone who maybe does like a couple of lucky hands of poker and then runs away from the table before anyone realizes that he was cheating.
Yeah.
Miguel, I'm sure, would be quite good at it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into that in a little bit, I think. But I would probably agree that Francisco is very likely someone that favors short-term gains over long-term goals.
I'm not fond of those people, those kind of people in 2020. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Open up the economy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Anyway, we're trying to get away from that for the time being.
Yeah, fair enough. The only other thing that came to mind when I was listening to you talk about the relationship between father and son, that really important quote from a future novel that we won't cover until a long time later on, is the idea that to a child, our parents are basically God. And so therefore, Miguel saying no to Francisco is basically saying no to God. Like, I don't remember exactly how old he was when that event happened where they get in good with the Asian family, and then they're picking through their belongings with the implication that Francisco has waylaid and killed all of them in order to take their stuff. That violent act was enough of a jarring moment that it had to be definitive for Miguel to stand up and say, no, I refuse to let myself be further tarnished by your crimes.
When I was re-listening to it, I couldn't quite tell if it was a case of he did kill them or they simply just made off like bandits in the night, and the crime was enough that these were the most kind people we ever came across, and you abused that trust. And the scene that comes to mind is in the second season of The Last Airbender, when Zuko and Iroh are taken in by a very kind earthbending family, and they, like, in the middle of the night, Zuko just takes one of their, not their horses, but they're the equivalent of in that world, and there's just this sadness that, like, as much as these people show a kindness and you feel like it could lead, there's the potential to lead to something of good, that our darker impulses and our need for short-term benefits will take advantage of that.
Mm. You're possibly right. Possibly Francisco didn't actually do violence to the Zhang family. I think when I was revisiting that, Miguel was talking about how he couldn't scrub the memory of their faces from his mind. Like, maybe it's just an empathic reaction to that his father stole from them. And as I recall, that is the moment where he specifically says to his father that he will not steal. Mm. So maybe that's all it is. It's just the image that came to mind when he was talking about not being able to scrub their faces from his mind, is the idea of them being in a rictus of fear and pain after being killed or something.
Yeah, I think it's certainly open that whatever happened, there was a betrayal, and one that was intense enough that Miguel resolved to never do something like that again. Mm-hmm. And I think that in either scenario, that's the important impulse that is taken away from it.
Well, that's another difficult note to end on. I hadn't originally intended it to be this way, but it was at this point in our recording that I realized we were running up against my pumpkin time, and we still had a lot of topics on our outline. Having reached a stopping point, we decided to stop here for that day and tackle the rest later. And as I was editing this episode, I naturally considered splitting it into two pieces. But our second Skype conversation on these chapters also runs to over 2 hours, so when the editing of this part won't seem to go so quickly, I decided to just let this be an extra long episode, and we'll see how the next one goes. For now, let's end on another Afrokelt track. This one is actually the very first one I ever heard, thanks to the musical artist they paired with. I first heard this song on pop radio,
And because I had been a Peter Gabriel fan from way back, I was intrigued enough to grab the album, which is how I learned to love a lot of these other musical pieces that I've been sharing along the way with you. While we still have more Miguel to discuss, I couldn't help but choose this track now, because the lyrics not only invoke the way Miguel fell into Rama from high atop the waterfall, but also the fall for Jarau herself thanks to the loss of Corral. She also didn't know which way was down. And in some ways, she has been trying to keep herself away from a mental ledge for a long time, lest she fall again. From the tag team of Peter Gabriel and Afrikheld, this is When You're Falling.
I can't get can't tell which way is down. Singing, when you're screaming.